I'm recording this introduction on the 1st of January, 2024. It's a very, very wet start to the new year where I live. So I have to time this in between rainstorms because my office and recording studio is in a tin shed. So even a little bit of rain sounds like a lot of rain. And it's been a lot of rain. So if you hear some background noise, that's the sound of a Queensland rainstorm on a tin roof. So it's New Year's Day. I personally don't really do New Year's resolutions. It feels like a fairly arbitrary thing to base the timing of your commitments and your goals on the movement of our planet around the sun. That, and as I'm sure you've learned for yourself, New Year's resolutions, well, if they really worked, I'd be a millionaire with a six-pack and three impeccably behaved kids. No, actually, just two kids. Saying that from this day onwards, I will forevermore start doing this or stop doing this and make rules about it, I don't know about you. Generally, just doesn't work for me. So rather than picking one day to change everything, I try to remember that every day, every moment, is an opportunity to commit and to recommit to your values and your goals, rather than waiting for the fireworks to start. Having said that, it is impossible to get to the 1st of January without a feeling of some degree of significance, right? Most of the world takes a moment to pause and to reset before the next round starts. So it's inevitable that we will have some sort of a review of how our year went, maybe beat ourselves up a little bit for how we failed to be the person that we wanted to be, and to hope that this year, I'll be better. So while I don't make flimsy promises to myself like, I'm going to exercise more, I'm going to start meditating every single day, or from this day onwards, I'll stop eating all the biscuits at work because who am I kidding? I do take stock in much broader terms to use that inevitable pensiveness that accompanies the new year, and also to leverage that sense of optimism and a fresh beginning to review and, if needs be, reset the general direction that I'm moving in. I picture it in my head as deciding where I want to head towards, then taking an anchor and hurling it with all of my might towards that place, and then slowly pulling myself towards that place with the anchor rope. That way, when I inevitably get distracted, blown off course, by all of the stuff that life throws at you, or when I lose discipline and mess up, it's really not a failure. You can always get up, reorientate, and start moving back towards that anchor. So that's New Year's for me. Checking to see if my anchor or my anchors are still in the right place, and then repositioning them if they are not. But I want to share something that I came across this week that provides a bit of a structure to this process. It's from the podcast of Mel Robbins. She explains that she does a similar annual review, but she uses a framework of six questions that she asks herself at the end of each year to help her pick her priorities for the year. I'm not going to recap her whole podcast here, but the six questions in brief are: number one, what are the highlights of my year? Number two, what were the hardest aspects of my year? Number three, what did I learn about myself? And then once she's done that review of the year, she then uses the following three questions to decide how she's going to move forward with the next year. So the fourth question is, what are the things I want to stop doing? Number five, what other things do I want to start doing? And number six, what are the things that I want to continue doing? So basically, what was good about my year? What sucked? What did I learn about myself? What do I want to do less of? What do I want to do more of? And what worked? Now again, I'm not going to review the entire process. Mel digs a lot into the details of how she decides what those highlights and the challenges were. And then she also divides those six questions into different categories like personal life and work life, money, finances, spirituality, things like that. But I wanted to underline two things that stood out for me. First off, the question of what do I want less of? The temptation for most of us is to think about what do I need more of this year? What do I need to add to my life to be better? But I love that one of the questions is what should I take away? What were the things that added to the suck or took up space that could be filled with good stuff? So I'll share a couple of things that I've come up with for myself that I want less of. I want less anger. Anger at my kids, at work frustrations, at myself. I want less screen time. I want less procrastination. I want to do less cleaning. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the lack of cleaning on the part of my kids contributes significantly to that anger that I want less of. I'm not sure how exactly I'm going to achieve it. Teaching my kids how to clean up after themselves would help. Maybe I need to find a way to be able to get a cleaner in once or twice a week. But by throwing my anchor out towards these I determine the direction I want to move in. I can work out the how as I go. The second thing I want to underline is question one and question six. What were the highlights and what am I doing that's working and I should keep doing? I love that it's the first and the last question because it means that you start and end the process with a question that can only inspire gratitude, which we all know is a major player in creating wellness, which is definitely one of the things that I want more of in 2024. So what about you? What are your anchors going to be for 2024? Okay, let's get to our episode. I can't think of a better way to help us decide where to throw our work anchors for 2024 than with a conversation with Dr. Gary Turnbull. I caught up with Gary at last year's Vets on Tour conference in Wanaka, New Zealand, where he was one of the guest speakers. I was loving Gary's sessions, but of course, I had many more questions for him. So I offered him a lift one day up the mountain for the daily ski sessions that happened at Vets on Tour between the morning and the evening lectures. But then as soon as I had him secured in a confined space, I put my new portable microphone on him and started recording a podcast. The result is kind of like carpool karaoke, but without the celebrities and without the singing. But who knows, maybe we'll work on the singing next time. I even stuck my phone on the dashboard to film us. So if you want to watch this interview instead of just listening, it is available as a video podcast on Spotify, and we will chuck it onto our YouTube channel as well. By the way, I've made sure that my name is back on the guest list for Wanaka 2024. It's definitely one of the answers for the things I want more of in 2024. It's booked for the 11th to the 16th of August, so block it off on your calendar, and we'll get you in the Vetveld carpool karaoke recording as we head up the mountain for a ski session. Dr. Gary Turnbull is a director at the Lincoln Institute, a coach, speaker, and facilitator in the fields of veterinary practice management and leadership, veterinary business models, and life balance strategies. He's also a former practice owner with decades of clinical vetting and leadership experience under his belt. Through his work at the Lincoln Institute, Gary helps practice owners and employees with people problems, team culture, staff engagement, productivity, and profit. And it's exactly the intersection between these things that I wanted to talk to Gary about. The seemingly opposing needs for productivity and profit from a practice owner's perspective with the desire of employed vets to have an engaged workplace with a great culture. I love Gary's role as a coach for both practice owners and employed vets because it gives them some unique insights into topics like how team leaders can motivate productivity without the team feeling that it's just another way that the boss wants the team to make more money for them. How to give and receive feedback about productivity. Why and how team leaders need to be crystal clear about their practice values. And for the employed vets, how to approach that annual review and how to show value when you are not the vet who bills those big surgeries. Gary also helps me with a guide to make those client money conversations a lot less anxiety inducing. And I put his coaching skills around conflict situations to the test with the big question. How do you deal with that accusation that all you care about is the money? You'll find Gary and his work at lincolninstitute.com.au, and I'll put a link in the show description to Lincoln's Veterinary Sustainability Pilot Study, which showed very strong evidence that improving your non-clinical skills can make a huge difference to your levels of job satisfaction and fulfillment. It makes for some really interesting reading. Okay, let's get into it. Oh, and Happy New Year. Dr. Gary Turnbull, welcome to the Vetveld podcast, a very different version of the Vetveld podcast. Where are we, Gary?
We're currently on our way from Wanaka to Cardrona ski fields, take on the slopes.
New Zealand at the Vets on Tour conference, Gary speaking at the conference, and I thought what an opportune moment to get him in a confined space where he can't go anywhere.
There was no escape. No. It's great. It's great to be here.
So many firsts for the Vetveld. A, we don't do video normally. Second, I normally have notes that might not sound that prepared, but I'm usually prepared and I have notes to guide the conversation. So this might be less of an interview and more of a ramble. But I'm excited. I'm really excited to chat to you. So quick background, I said we don't do bios, but you coach for the Lincoln Institute, coach practices. Also coach, you do programs for employed vets, right? It's not just practice owners. So which actually gives you a unique insight because the two can sometimes clash a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
But then you were also until when a practice owner of a very successful vet practice, right?
Yeah. So I guess super quick historically, practice owner, for years, okay. from 2000 to 2020 with my wife. And it was along that journey that I recognized that I think I was a good technician, I was a good clinician. And so many veterinarians ended up in practice ownership and realized along the way that there was a whole skill set that I simply didn't have. How to lead a team of people, how to develop and execute on sound business strategy. All of that was completely foreign to me. And I just figured for some reason it would just work out for the best. And we did okay, but there was so much area where we could improve the experience for our team, where we could be more successful, more prosperous commercially, which meant freedom to reinvest in our people and our practice and enjoy a better sort of balance in life as well. Having been mentored by the founder of Lincoln Institute, Paul Ainsworth, who's got amazing expertise in both personal and executive leadership through his experience in the Australian infantry and his work in the corporate sector in Australia, having completed an MBA, that really just profoundly changed my experience as a practice owner and as a veterinarian and as a person, to be honest. Yeah. And I felt compelled to share that with like-minded colleagues, hence Lincoln's direction into the veterinary profession specifically.
Okay. Now, usually the other difference in this conversation is I normally prep people for some of the questions. I normally kick off with a statement that I saw on a graffiti on the side of a building that said, bad decisions lead to good stories. So I ask my guests, do you agree? And you can disagree. You can say, I've had people say, no, they've had some very traumatic repercussions from bad decisions. Or if you do agree, do you have an example of a story of that fits with that?
Yeah, okay. So bad decisions lead to...
good stories.
Good stories. They certainly lead to good stories. I guess my immediate response to that, without having time to think about it too much, is it depends on mindset. For me, is my immediate reaction, because what's a bad decision anyway? It's almost like that line of thinking, a failure is only a failure if you call it a failure. A bad decision is probably only a bad decision if there's not some learnings from it and growth, either personally and or professionally and as an organisation. In terms of an example, I will need to think for a minute. I'm sure there's plenty of bad decisions along the way, but just trying to think of one specifically.
You can come back to it.
Yeah.
Okay, come back to that. I'll edit it back in.
Yeah, okay.
First thing I want to start with, and I think you're probably the perfect person to talk to this because of your role in Lincoln. You've been an owner. A lot of this stuff, and I agree that it's really vital stuff. I've been an owner as well, and I've worked for some, I was going to say bad bosses, not bad people, just people who don't have the skills or the stuff they should learn, but they don't make the time for it. But on the flip side, the perception from employed vets, and I know this from speaking to vets, is sometimes they're not, let's say I'm a practice owner and I decide I'm going to go with Lincoln and we're going to start teaching these skills. We talked last night, your talk was about getting owners to yes. And there's a lot of stuff that can sometimes feel to a vet, the boss is teaching me how to make him more money. I'm doing all the work. I'm not really interested in this shit. I just want to do my vet work. And it adds stress to my life because the stuff you're asking me to do increases conflict sometimes, which we'll come back to. I want to ask you about conflict. So I don't want to engage with this stuff. And it, to some degree, I mean, you guys do teach practices how to be more commercially successful. So it does come down to money to some degree as well. How do you integrate the two? How do you get the buy-in from the team without coming across as, hey, guys, make more sales, make me more money. And then the vets can also, sometimes if it is a successful practice owner, I don't know, do you ever find that there's resentment to go, the boss goes on 4 overseas holidays a year and he has a holiday house in Byron Bay and I'm on $40 an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, I think this comes down to leadership nuance and the messaging and really the purpose behind doing whatever we're going to do, because nothing will demotivate a veterinarian more than a conversation like, we've looked at some numbers and benchmarks tell us that you should be doing 2.2 more radiographs per week.
And that's what happens, right?
Yeah.
This happens.
Yep. Which is a really bad conversation. because it's poorly delivered feedback with all the wrong motivation behind it. What on earth does 2.2 more x-rays per week mean? And so the nuance is shifting the focus, and this is authentic, this is not contrived in any way, shifting it back to our purpose. And this is where fundamentally a lot of practices have a gap in the first place is, why do we do what we do? Why do we as a team turn up every day to take on and tackle what we do? And our profession is pretty clear what we do. We keep well animals well through preventative healthcare, and we treat sick and injured to restore them to health. So the what we do is pretty straightforward. The how we do it, that's your unique selling proposition. What makes you different from the practice down the road? Where gets overlooked by organizations or veterinary practices is, why do we do this?
Mm.
And that's important at a personal level as well. Why do we turn up to work every day and do what we do? And that's going to be very, very personal and different for each individual. And that's where it starts, is why do we do this? And from integrating the commercial with the purpose motive, if we can tap into our sense of purpose, and for most, a strong element of that is going to be patient advocacy, is some version of I'm the voice for those who can't speak for themselves.
Yep.
And for some, it will be that combined with I'm here to help people. Oh, I make a contribution to the world by helping people. The currency through which I help them is their pets, or in a mixed setting, it's that kind of business to business relationship, and I'm make an investment in me, and I'll provide a return on that investment in your business and your business success. And this is something that's well recognized. Good medicine, or practice good medicine, and the commercial component will take care of itself.
Yeah.
The messaging is really got to be aligned with what's our purpose as an organization. Let's talk about your purpose personally, and aligning with that, being a patient advocate, making a difference, making a positive contribution for pets and their families, or in the primary producer setting for businesses, is ultimately going to lead indirectly to great commercial results.
So for the employed vet, actually no, let's ask this question, because you mentioned the conversation about you should do your average invoice is too low. Does that conversation sometimes have to be had in some extent? Because you've got to look at KPIs, you've got to look at measures. I understand as a business owner, if there is a team member that stands out, that goes, everybody's here and you're down here, we have to look at the why. So sometimes, does that conversation have to be had always?
I think that the starting point is one of the reasons why we have to have those difficult conversations is because expectations aren't set clearly enough in the first place.
Okay.
So often your reasons for underperformance, as it were, is because there's ambiguity around either our practice values and or the standards of care that we recognize and look to adopt within our practice. And so you can have a situation where every clinician is running their own race a little bit.
Okay.
Rather than a more collaborative approach where we all agree, this is how we do it here. And that will be closely linked to, as I said, standards of care and the values and the vision of the practice as well. And when that's missing, vague goals lead to vague results. So if I don't know what you're expecting of me, chances are I'm not going to meet your expectations. People don't turn up to work to let you down on purpose. They don't. It's not an act of defiance. It's usually because those expectations aren't set clearly enough in the first place. And it's easy to make assumptions because as a business owner, I view it this way, or I view the world this way. We're all guilty of that egocentric bias. I tend to think everybody thinks the way I do. So the first step is ensuring that we've got really clear expectations.
So what does that look like? Does it start at the interview? the start of the interview where you say, look, we're looking for a vet. Here's how we do it. We are a high level practice where we do the workups, or say, look, we're in a socioeconomically poorer area, and be clear about how we practice and what we expect. And if that doesn't fit with you, I don't know that you'll like working for us.
Yeah. Look, I think it's important to position the practice and what your philosophy or approach is, what the vision or the sense of purpose is. And I guess we'd also be hoping at that interview stage that there's going to be some good questions around that as well.
Yeah.
We're going to be careful in recruitment in terms of leading people.
Yeah.
It'd be really easy to say, here's our practice values. What do you think? That's a pretty easy one to answer. Yeah, I love it. I agree with all of that.
Yeah.
So it's flipping that around. So tell me, what are the things in life that you value most?
Yeah.
And looking to explore their values and looking for alignment with that. And then hoping in reverse, when we are the person we're interviewing, any questions for us, that's going to be really instructive as well as, or insightful as to what questions, what's important to them.
Okay. So we do know though that people tell you what they think you want to hear in an interview.
Yeah.
So it's not a foolproof way. So let's say I've employed a vet, or I am an employer and I've never had this conversation, and now I want to start getting better at this thing. So at some point I do have to have a conversation to say, well, look, it's 3 months into your employment. You're not delivering financially, but again, it's, we said before, it's not about the finances. How do you frame that? How do you approach that conversation in a way that doesn't sound like you're not making me enough money?
Yeah.
Because people react to that in a very bad way. I can tell you that from the social media pages.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And quite rightly, they should. The conversation is really more about, in the first instance, gathering information, entering this with curiosity, understanding what's going on for them.
Mm-hmm.
And having some data around that can be really helpful as well, because there's probably two key aspects of what's going on in the conversations in the consultation room. One is, what's my propensity to make a best recommendation, whatever best looks like within your practice, again, coming back to standards of care and values. Because it's not uncommon, as we were talking about last night, it's not uncommon for veterinarians to slip into this mindset of wallet guardian or purse protector.
Yep.
So I'm going to make some assumptions here about what the client wants, and I will make some compromises in my recommendations because that will save them some money. And that's a good thing. As opposed to making the recommendations that align with expectations, so standards of care, and letting the client decide.
Yes.
So number one is, what's going on there from a self-worth and mindset perspective? And what are those conversations being had or not being had? And secondly is the ability to possibly influence a client to yes with your ethical recommendations. Because that's another area we know from our own research that veterinarians really dislike financially related conversations. And so there's often a lot of ambiguity in those conversations, a lot of use of inferential language. What we ideally do in these situations, what we could do in this situation.
Inferential meaning trying to infer.
Yeah.
Trying to infer that you should do a dental. But I'm not telling you, look, we should do a dental. You're going to a lot of pain.
Yeah. So a simple example would be to say to somebody, I'm thirsty, rather than asking, can I have a drink? It's rowing information out there.
Can you talk to my wife?
and hoping that the recipient will pick up on that. And clients need to be led to an extent. You know, there is, in that room, there is a layperson or laypeople who know very little, if anything, and there is a relative expert in the room. And as that expert, we have, I think, a responsibility to support the decision-making process with our expertise.
Yeah.
And for a lot of veterinarians, because they get caught up in the issue of money, which is really for the client to decide and determine, not them, is to struggle with focusing on being the patient advocate and making the best recommendations in the patient's interests, being mindful, of course, of the client as well, but doing that in a collaborative fashion.
Yeah.
So bringing the client in and not cutting corners or compromising based on what they think the client might want. So having some data around those two aspects is really helpful because it helps us to target the conversation. Because it's a very different conversation between someone who is electing for, say, a therapeutic trial
yep.
over diagnostics, thinking that that's the best way to go because they're saving the client money,
yep.
versus a conversation where a veterinarian is making recommendation after recommendation and clients are declining time and again because the message is getting lost in inferential language or because we've delivered a multitude of options and now the client is confused.
Yep.
There's a whole range of factors there that can lead a client more to a not yet as opposed to a hard no.
Let's put that into practice. I'm your employer. I look at the numbers and there is 40% below everybody else on the average invoice. How do I do this with you? I come to you, I say, hey, Gary, look, I'd love to chat to you about these invoice things. Here's the data, here are the facts.
Yeah.
I'm not that interested in the finances specifically, but I want to understand why that is because I just want to make sure that you're not getting stuck on getting the clients to take your recommendation, or I want to make sure that you are recommending the correct treatment and not having some sort of a blah. Is that the sort of conversation that have?
The conversation would have nothing to do with money or finances at all.
So the money finance thing, it's a symptom basically.
Yeah.
You see it as an early warning sign symptom.
Yeah.
Let's look at the cause.
It's a measure to help us simply understand what's going on.
Okay.
One of the keys to feedback, successfully delivering feedback, is it needs to be specific and it needs to be accurate. And so it's not going to land if we're talking in broad brushstrokes. I've got a general sense of this, or I get the feeling that quite rightly the recipient should start with, can you give me an example?
Yep.
The metrics is simply the data that moves us from opinion to fact.
Okay.
We don't want to be talking in opinion. We need to be delivering accurate and specific information that's based on fact.
Quick little detour.
Yeah, yeah.
That's okay.
Cool.
I think a lot of vets are open to getting that feedback because we want to know that we do a good job, right?
Yeah.
It's almost worse to have no feedback. I don't know if you know if the boss liked me or they just put up with me because they can't find anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing that I see often, and I think this was a thing for me as well, is when the measure of this thing is the average invoice, if that's the sole measure, it can be misleading depending on your role in the practice. I think I'm a pretty decent consulting vet and medicine person. I'm not an orthopedic surgeon. I could be the number one vet for booking in cruciate surgeries very quickly for the surgeon.
Yes.
I'm not doing the surgery. I'm not billing the surgery. The surgeon's invoices, his average invoice is twice mine, and the boss thinks he's amazing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The vets. How do you coach owners or vets on that? How do you to approach that?
Certainly from a practice leader perspective, we really need more data than an average transaction fee for exactly the reason that you highlight there. And one of the limitations of a lot of practice management softwares is that you can plug in a report and it'll give you each veterinarian's name and it'll give you their total income generated. Right. It'll give you an average transaction fee, but it doesn't dig down to that next level, as I mentioned, is how often are we making recommendations and how often are we converting those recommendations?
Because
they're just two very, very different conversations.
I might be excellent at booking my rejects, but then it's a reduced consult fee, so it pulls my average down.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So we need more data to be working with than simply an average transaction fee. And also recognizing that the value that the clinician brings to the table is not just based on dollars and cents.
Yep.
There are the factors, like you quite rightly point out, you can have a rainmaker who is incredibly sophisticated in the consult room and get the clients to a yes, but doesn't actually do the technical work.
Yeah.
So it can look quite misleading. yeah, we might all, there are other aspects in terms of coaching and mentoring other team members, the contribution they make to continuing development. We might delegate other activities to them that contributes to the overall success and outcome of the practice. So we've got to look beyond KPI. It doesn't mean we ignore them.
Yeah.
But we've got to look at enough data to have a meaningful conversation.
Okay.
And we've got to also place appropriate weighting on that as well in terms of the overall product or outcome that we're looking from the veterinarian themselves.
So as an owner, what do you look at? How do you, because of that, some of those things are actually quite hard to measure, especially if you're not on the floor. It's all right if you're there 5 days a week and you see how much clients love this vet. But if you're not, let's say I've got 3 branch practices and I don't ever spend time with vet X and numbers, she's not a great vet. Well, great employee, she might be a great vet.
Yeah.
How do you measure that?
That's where there needs to be, in the instance where we're not at the coalface all day, every day, or at least frequently, there's got to be some leadership pipeline. We're going to have somebody with some level of responsibility and leadership who can help provide insight on this. Because we need that feedback on how everybody's performing. So there's got to be a level of leadership within any site. And this is often where we find a shortcoming for veterinary practices.
Yeah.
Is that there is actually, there's no on-site leadership.
Yeah.
And the team are making the rules up themselves. Because if you don't set clear expectations or set the rules, they'll make them up. And or the wrong person is appointed into a position of leadership and responsibility.
Yep.
And it's because they're the one who's been working there the longest, or they're the oldest, or they're technically the most capable. Doesn't mean they've got any of the attributes or talents that are required for leadership. Or finally, we might select the right person, but then fail to upskill them.
Okay.
Because it's a completely different responsibility and value set to their role in the technical capacity.
Okay.
So we've got to have that pipeline of the right people that are adequately upskilled.
We're going to have to pause because we're going to have to key. We'll do part two. But I do want to say, because many people might be in a practice, employed in a practice that doesn't have the right. There's very few practices who has
very
the
true.
Perfect. So in that scenario, I have mentored some of my mentees to say and told them, because it comes into play when you start looking at salary negotiations.
Yep.
They want to get a pay increase, but they know they're going to get their numbers thrown in front of them as a defense almost.
Yeah.
And I've mentored them to say, well, keep track of it. Have a little notebook to say, I've booked, booked this and this and this. So that when you go in to say, well, I've booked, I haven't done, but I've booked $300,000 worth of surgery. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think anything we measure, as soon as you start to measure, it'll start to improve. And it was very true what you said before. We used to talk KPIs with our veterinarians as part of the conversation. Again, not with the profit motive in mind, but tying it back to sense of purpose.
Yeah.
If it's got to be incredibly frustrating if you're making recommendations and clients are not taking on that recommendation, it's got to be frustrating and disappointing because you're not getting to do the work that you were trying to do and that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
Your patient is not getting the best care and you won't have ultimately the happiest client. So tell me what's going on. What are clients saying no to? Let's see if we can address this and talk about ways by which we can improve that experience for you. Because we get a win-win-win. You're doing the work that you were trained to do and passionate about. You're achieving better patient outcomes. You've got a happier client. And the practice is more financially prosperous, which means we can
pay you more.
Recognize you well financially. We can pay you well. We can invest in your development. We can invest in facilities and equipment.
Yeah.
So it all stems from that purpose and what's going on for you. And as I said, it's a different conversation. If it's we're not making recommendations in the first place, tell me about that.
Yeah.
What's going on for you? Why, in these instances, why are we defaulting to a therapeutic trial as opposed to diagnostics, as an example?
Yeah.
And exploring that and understanding. And often it's just the language. Veterinarians can get trapped in this mindset of, oh, I didn't find anything abnormal on the x-rays, so I've just wasted their money. And setting the client's expectations. Oh, now I've got to tell them the x-rays were normal. Let's flip that around and start with, look, I hope that I find nothing serious on these x-rays. Hopefully they'll come back. Oh, it's going to be some soft tissue swelling and nothing else. That's my hope. But the only way that we can have peace of mind is to do the diagnostics and see what we find. If I do find anything abnormal that's clinically really significant, I'll ring you straight away so we can talk about what we're going to do about that.
Yeah.
But hopefully it's going to be all clear, and then you and I both have the peace of mind that we're not missing anything.
Yeah, I nod vigorously because 100% that was me. I still struggle with it. I have that wallet. We'll talk about money in part two.
Yeah.
And money issues, personal money issues. But I definitely had and still have a bit of a wallet. I don't want to waste people's money.
Yeah,
exactly
yeah.
that. Yeah. I don't like waste in general. So I used to be really bad at saying, I think we can get away without x-rays or whatever thing. But it's exactly that. A, it's understanding more. The more I learn clinically, the more I grow. I have a better understanding now of, okay, this is why we should really do it.
Yeah.
And then reframing it to the client. That big reframe was massive for me to go, look, I don't think there's a big issue. Well, it probably is this, but it is my job to make sure that it's nothing more and to warn you about the other things.
Yeah.
So x-ray would be great to rule out this, this, and this, and this. Because if it is that, it's a way different story. So if it's okay with you, if it's doable,
yeah,
let's do the x-rays, then we can all relax about it.
Yeah.
If you can't, no dramas. We can't. I'm quite happy to treat because, as I said at the beginning, it's probably nothing.
Yeah.
But if I miss it, it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the difference between not giving the client the choice to make that decision in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, based on assumption, I'll save them some money here. Mm. For most clients, look, and there are, of course, there are clients that where cost is the primary concern.
I'm one of those clients.
And no judgment there at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. However, let's let the client make that decision.
Yeah.
Let's focus on being the best patient advocate because the vast majority of clients do want peace of mind.
Yeah.
They do want surety. Yeah. They do want to know. They want to be, they want validation. They want to know that they're good
parents. That's why they're there.
Exactly. That's exactly right. They're there for a reason.
And it's changed for me. It's interesting. I find it much easier since starting to work in emergency because the realization that it's midnight, this person's here for something that I think's nothing, but they're clearly very worried. To get there at midnight and pay a double consult fee, they want to know.
Absolutely.
So then I go, it's really a disservice to go, hey, it's probably nothing, don't worry about it.
Yeah. And the minute we start to compromise, we increase the risk of misdiagnosis. We increase the risk of unnecessary patient suffering. We suffer an increased level of dissatisfaction because we're not really doing the best that we were trained to do. We're not getting to exercise that expertise that we've spent so long to develop. The risk of complaint escalates. Mm. It's very rare that a client would complain at any level because too much was done, as long as we set clear expectations around costs.
Yeah.
So if they understand that, it's almost invariably because the veterinarian didn't do enough.
Yeah, and I want to differentiate, and we've got to go skiing, so we've got to wrap it up. But differentiate complaints and a whinge.
Mm.
They'll whinge about the money.
Of course, yeah.
Genuine complaints.
We all do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But a genuine complaint, that's going to come from underservicing, from missing something.
Yeah. Remember, nobody wants to spend the money.
Oh, no. Sure.
They know they need to, but nobody wants to do that. Yeah. So it is important to recognize that, oh, that's expensive. That's very expensive. Yeah, it is.
It's a lot of money.
It is it really is. And unfortunately, medicine is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's part two. Part two will be my personal counseling on my own money issues.
Sounds good.
While Gary and I head up the mountain for a ski, I thought I would take a second to remind you about our specialist support space. We've created a space where you can chat to a specialist about those frustrating cases where you can't refer or it's not quite a referral case, but you just need a little bit of extra brain power or experience to help you get over that hump. You can upload files and images like x-rays or videos, or you can even jump on a live chat if the case requires it. I'm actually quite enjoying using the space to help me unpack cases after the fact, where things didn't necessarily go according to plan. It is a paid space so that our specialists get compensated for their time, which has the added benefit that you no longer have to feel guilty about asking for free advice. But we've tried to keep it widely accessible by pricing it at around $15 a month, which lets you ask as many questions as you want. For now, we have a specialist in small animal medicine, emergency and critical care, as well as dermatology. Check out the details and the T's and C's by clicking on the link for this space in the episode show description, and go give it a try. Okay, let's get back to Gary.
We're back. Part two.
Here we go.
Of our post-ski chat. How did you go on the slopes?
Yeah, look, I was pretty happy. No stacks off the chairlift. That's a big improvement for me, so I'm happy with the day.
Nothing broken. tired, happy?
Yeah, no injuries, so it's a win.
So I can't quite remember where we left off, but I think we should talk about the money conversation.
Right? Yeah.
It is still a hard conversation for vets to have. I know you did the social styles yesterday and the amiables, us conflict avoiding, people pleasing. And we want to do the work, right? We want to fix the animals. And then we've got to say, and it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. And still 20 odd years in, that's big issue for me. I still, when it comes to, and I've complete confidence in what I want to do. And I don't believe that it's overcharging. But then I have to go out there, I do my estimate, and I have to go out there and say, yeah, this life-saving surgery we need to do, it's going to be X thousand.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find it really hard.
You're not alone.
I know.
There's not too many veterinarians that don't find that a real challenge.
I think, I had a thought last night when you were talking. You think it's maybe because you talked about what is expensive. It's a very relative term, what is a lot of money. It depends on who you are. But do you think maybe if part of it is also because we're not a massive earning profession, so just tell somebody that you're going to be $5,000-$6,000 out of pocket for something would hurt me a lot personally, because it's a lot of money. If I had to go to a mechanic and they said, yeah, your gearbox is going to be $5,000, I wouldn't be angry at him, but I'd be very sad. And then add to that hopefully we can talk about empathy as well. I see a family coming with young kids and I know I've got to tell them, you're going to be $5,000 out of pocket. It's a stress. Mm. And I feel for them before I even say it. Maybe they feel less about it than I do, but I feel for it.
I certainly wonder about that. And I think what can happen is, and it's not that it's not important for us to be taking all of this into consideration, but at the end of the day, our expertise is around veterinary medicine.
Yeah.
And it's our clinical expertise that the general public are coming to us for.
Yep.
And I think we can just get a little lost or off track in terms of that primary or intrinsic sense of purpose, shifting away from being the patient advocate and just moving more towards, we use that term, the wallet guardian or the purse protector, which where that sense of purpose starts to refocus or migrate towards money. And at the end of the day, that's the client's responsibility. That's the client's, the family's decision. And it's not just about money either. It's very much about personal values and priorities. Yeah. There are, you see the two ends of the spectrum, clients that are clearly not challenged financially, and yet don't place a high value on their pets, so unwilling to spend a lot of money. And then there are others who will forego themselves in order to pursue the best treatment option based on their veterinarian's recommendation, whatever the cost, they'll make it work. It's not just about money. It's people's personal value set and how they prioritize their pet within their family unit. Interestingly, I was meeting with Stephen Feldman, the president and founder of the Human Animal Bond Research Institute, just recently. And he was saying in their research, 84% of pet owners consider their pet to be a member of the family. If it was one of our children, we don't ignore the cost of treatment, but it's put into perspective with the outcome we're looking to achieve, which is to repair, fix, heal, maintain.
Yeah, see, I get all of this rationally. My rational brain agrees with you 100%. Yeah. Have you heard about the concept? I think I've spoken about it before on the podcast. Somebody else told me about it. The concept of your brain, the elephant rider. Have you heard
of
it?
No, I've not heard of it, no.
So there's psychologists who explain the difference between your emotional brain to the limbic system and your rational brain, which we're all aware of. But when I used to think about that, I always felt like, the rational's in charge. And there's the underlying, maybe it's 80-20 or at least 50-50. But this psychologist wrote about it. It says, no, it is like a person riding a trained elephant. The elephant is the emotional part. The rider is in charge when things are going well.
Yeah.
But if things are not going well, if the elephant gets upset, then you've got no chance.
You
have no hope. You hold on and you hope for the best and you hope he just calms down, which when you talk about, for me, the money thing, the elephant takes over.
Yeah.
I sit there going, gotta go talk to them, forgot to say. And I've often wondered about why. What is it that I find so uncomfortable?
Yeah. Yeah. And look, yeah, there is some work around a sense of self-worth among veterinarians. And that we, and this is of course generalizing, that as a community or a profession, we struggle to value ourselves well. I think that strong empath component drives us to want to deliver results, irrespective of money. The number of veterinarians that I've spoken to that say, I would just do it all for free if I possibly could.
Yeah, because you just want to get the work done.
Yeah.
That's what we're there to do.
Yeah.
And the money is I understand it's a lubricant, but it can feel like a stumbling block.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and we talk about it is an exchange. What we're delivering is years and years and years of education and dedication and development to develop that clinical mastery to provide the clinical care that we do. And of course, the exchange for that is money.
Yep.
And that's that fundamental of reciprocity. One thing I would say, and I, of course, mentioned this last night, is that I often talk about the three voices in the room.
Yeah.
The one, the voice of reason that our client can hear, that is listening and providing information to the client based on clinical findings and differential diagnoses and treatment plans or ways forward and so forth. Obviously the client's voice, which they're sharing their perspective historically and providing feedback to what we're saying.
Yep.
And then I truly believe, and certainly it was true for me in 20 years of practice, there is just that niggling little voice that might be conscious, might be subconscious, but it's making comments like, or asking questions like, what if they say no?
Mm.
What if they say yes, but they actually can't afford it?
Yep.
What if they think I'm over-servicing or being pushy? What if they don't like me? What if they go somewhere else? There's all these questions going on in the background, and I think that's where that emotional brain can start to kick in and we start to waver. And of course, we're very good at picking up on nonverbal cues.
Yeah.
Tone of voice, facial expression, body language. So if we're uncomfortable, if we're demonstrating discomfort at the point of money, the client is going to pick up on that.
Yep.
Almost guaranteed. And they're going to be thinking, what's going on here? One of the solutions that we've implemented with veterinarians through education and has certainly produced profound results based on objective and subjective measurement is to provide, for want of a better term, a system.
Mm.
A six-step system within the consultation room. And that allows the veterinarian to create somewhat of a habit. And habits, like that allows us to switch off, because when we're in a habit, we're in autopilot. So we're trying to create a habit in the consult room, which creates a sense of disconnect from that voice, or it silences the voice.
Okay.
Because I just, now I'm up to step three. So now I'll do step three. Now I'll move on to step four. Now it's step five. And by following a sequence, the more one practices that, the more it becomes habitual, and certainly the more it silences that niggling voice that creates the questions.
So what are the six steps? Do we have to pay for this?
No, look, it starts with just preparing ourselves, and that might only take 30 seconds to a minute, particularly this transitioning from the last consult to the next consult. And in some experiences, it might be moving from a euthanasia to a puppy vaccination or vice versa. It can just simply be going from a challenging diagnostic case to the next.
Yeah.
And so just taking a minute or so to prepare and recalibrate, reflecting on the last experience and through an optimistic lens, how did I improve? What did I do?
Mm-hmm.
Followed by just resetting, getting present again, and then committing to the outcome we're looking for. And that is to deliver the very best ethical recommendations based on your knowledge, the standards of care that are adopted within your practice values and so forth, and ensuring to the best of your ability you create a positive experience for your patient, minimizing fear and anxiety for them, and a positive experience for your client. And largely there is to ensure that they leave the practice without being confused. And I think that's one of the most overlooked challenges that we face, is that we're operating in a world that is completely foreign to our clients. And particularly when we start delivering lots of options, it can become quite confusing. And in the face of confusion and overwhelm, a client will defer decision making, and you'll hear something like, "Okay, we'll have a think about that, and we'll let you know." So just a first step is just a little mental, emotional, and physical reset to bring your best self into that interaction. The second step is building rapport. It's easy sometimes because we have loyal clients who've known us for years, and that rapport is already there. But what we recognize is that for people to buy from us, and of course, whether we like it or not, in that consult room, we are in sales, non-sales selling. We're selling a diagnosis or a diagnostic plan. We're selling a treatment plan. We're selling a procedure. And therefore, for people to buy from us, they need to trust us and they need to like us. Trust and likability are fundamental. So we're going to spend a short period of time just building rapport with our clients. And there's a multitude of ways through which we can do that. We talk a lot about both verbal and non-verbal cues and energy levels and so forth. So a short period of time just in that rapport building phase, that comes more naturally to some people, those who are more people oriented, more task oriented though, that's going to require a little bit more conscious effort. It won't be quite such a natural reflexive action. Then the third step is to what we would term create the need, and that's essentially collecting history, performing an examination, and identifying the problem list, as it were. If it's a preventative health care examination and say vaccination, then we don't have a problem list as such. Yeah. It's more about it. Everything checks out okay. We'll make sure that all our preventatives are up to date, no questions nutritionally, and we'll now administer the prophylactic medication that the visit's based on. But in many instances, of course, that will be that the patient was presented with a concern or health problem, and we will be exploring that. And along the way, we may find other unidentified concerns as well. And that's particularly where that little voice about, what if they think I'm over-servicing or being pushy, comes to the fore. When, as a veterinarian, I've got to have a conversation with my client about something that they don't know about, and bringing something into their sort of conscious awareness. And that can make veterinarians very uncomfortable. So we create the need, and then we move to warming that. And by warming the need, we're talking about presenting things in a way that's going to resonate for the client who is buying. And by that, I mean we're positively influencing our clients to a yes with our best ethical recommendations. So that's kind of work for them. And so, as I mentioned last night with the group that we're working with, as scientists and being high detail and evidence-based, we often revert to the features. So let me talk to you about all the things that we're going to do. And that's not necessarily speaking to the part of the brain that does the decision-making or the buying decision. It's much more the emotional centers that are driving that. Yeah. So I'm not saying that we don't have to discuss those sort of features, what's involved. In fact, that's a critical part. But start with the benefits. So we talk about and bring some emotion into it so it's going to resonate with the decision-making parts of the brain for our client. And one of the most powerful things and what clients want is peace of mind. Or they want surety. And so when we make a recommendation, coupling that with the recognition that this is how I can provide peace of mind for you and for me as the clinician. This is the only way we can know, or these steps are what's going to allow us to know what's actually going on here. So that would be number one. Number two is validation. It's just like parents. Every parent wants to know that they're good parents. Equally, pet owners want to know that they're a good pet parent. So validation that this is the best that we can do here. If you're here to learn and follow through on what's the very best for your pet, here's what it is. And then just their connection, their emotional connection with their pet. So an example might be if we're talking about periodontal disease or any form of oral disease and the halitosis that goes with that. Once we've done this, you can get up close and have cuddles and kisses again without all that offensive odour.
Yeah.
Or if we're looking at resolving chronic pruritus or otitis, you can both get a good night's sleep again here rather than both of you being up all night because of the scratching and so forth. So it's just zeroing in on what's important to them and what's going on for them as well as their pet.
Okay.
So so we focus on the benefits. We do that from two directions. One is, this is the benefit of doing this. And then here's the ongoing challenge or the risk, if you like, if we don't do this, because that sort of orientation will connect more for some people than others. And then we move into the features. And this is where we want to be really clear on what we're proposing and why, and really building in value. Because very often it's thought by veterinarians that the biggest barrier to compliance is costs. The data suggests that that's simply not true. Okay. Looking at a survey of pet owners, that in fact, the biggest money or financial issue is perception of value. And if I'm not seeing the perception of value, I'm going to delay a decision or I'm going to decline the recommendation. And that's much more common than genuine affordability or lack thereof. So really painting the picture of what we're going to do, that making the invisible visible, because everything we do happens behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And therefore, whilst it's normal to us and it's what we do all day, every day, the general public have very little appreciation for the complexity of what we do and the risks involved and so forth. Just making the invisible visible. And that can be done through just working through a treatment plan. Here's what we're proposing to do. Here's all the things we need, and focus on what the patient needs rather than the cost. And that can be supported by photographs, it can be supported by videos. There's lots we can do to really make the invisible visible. Once we've done that, we need to ask the client if they're happy to proceed. Once we've made our recommendation, and this is again where a lot of veterinarians fall down because they're so conflict averse, they will use inferential language. This is what we could do. This is what we ideally do. We might need to do something about this in the future, as opposed to, here's our best way forward. Here's why. Is that okay? And let the client decide. And of course, let them ask as many questions as they may have as well. And the final one is just avoiding buyer's remorse. And of course, buyer's remorse is that shift in decision after committing, which can be a real frustration too from the perspective of running our day if we've got procedures booked in and then people change their mind and just to decide not to turn up.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of a very superficial view of something that is quite complex, but nevertheless, six steps that with practice can become a
real... So where in that do we mention the money? Because I understand that we've got to show the value.
Yeah.
So all of that makes a lot of sense, but at what point then do you go, and it's going to be X?
Yeah. So that's at that fifth step.
Okay.
So we've talked about the benefits first. We've talked about the benefit of doing this. Here's the upside. Here's the outcome. Here's the risk if we don't. Now we're going to move into the features. So we're going to talk about, it might be we're talking about anesthesia and fluid therapy and the radiographs or the diagnostics, whatever it might be, the things that we're going to do and why we're going to do them. And really it is a case of step by step, this built-in perception of value. And in terms of cost, here's where we're sitting at.
That I love talking about that stuff. I'm proud that I know it and I'm proud of the services we offer. For in my life, to make it a selfish thing, it's emergency work. Almost always those procedures are fairly urgent.
Yes.
So thinking about the last financial situation I had was a big stitch up, massive gash on the dog's back. It's open. It can't really wait. It's got to be fixed.
Yeah.
And the price is X.
Yeah.
And it's not small.
Yeah.
And the hardest part for me, I think, where the elephant responds, where the elephant reacts is, hey, when you say their number and their face looks like you've just kicked them in the nuts or something, like a gut punch. How much? That reaction, I react to it. I know it's my own issue, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Is there something you could do about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you guys recommend, a random question actually,
yeah,
having a price list on a website or something like that? Because then at least there's not that surprise element. So when you talk about the stuff in their head, at least they know, okay, I'll probably look me at a couple of thousand. Or
yeah. Look, I think the challenge with a price list is there's so many complexities and unknowns and variables that gets quite challenging.
But on a vague list, say, average orthopedic surgery is 5,000 or whatever.
Yeah. Look, I would say it's more about shifting the focus away from money. And what we're tapping into, I mentioned before that and again, whether we like it or not, every one of these conversations is essentially a negotiation.
Yeah.
And one of the most powerful negotiating tools that we have, and we don't recognize it, is what's called the power of legitimacy.
The what?
The power of legitimacy.
Oh, the power of legitimacy.
Yeah. And a simple example of the power of legitimacy is a restaurant menu. The restaurant menu doesn't just tell you the various dishes on offer. It gives you a description of what you're going to get. And then there's a number. And once there's a number and it's printed on paper, that's created a sense of, here's the proposition or here's the proposal. And because it's printed on paper, it's a non-negotiable. We don't ask the wait staff, I really would like the ribeye tonight, but do you mind if I just pay $49 for it? It's a non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And using a treatment plan or a diagnostic plan in the same way, we're instantly shifting the focus away from money and towards, here is what your pet needs.
Yeah.
Or here is what we need to do to get from problem to solution. And so it's very much about, as I said, the features of what we're going to do. Much of the ribeye comes with garlic butter and blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
And by the way, here's what we're looking at cost-wise.
Did you ever struggle with that? When you need to say the dollar amount? Or is it something that you had to work at?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's something that most veterinarians have to work on. What is exciting is that, and I alluded to measurement, when we provide, and we've done this with well over 1,000 veterinarians, provide dedicated training to this, to upskill in this sort of non-technical or non-clinical competency. We have measured a almost 100% increase in a veterinarian's propensity to make a recommendation. And by that, let's go to the diagnostics rather than therapeutic trial, or let's take that option of here's what's best for peace of mind.
Yep.
And we've also doubled the ability of a veterinarian to get their client to a yes. And there is a win there, because it means veterinarians doing the work that they were trained to do, they're achieving superior patient outcomes. That's going to lead to a happier client. And it also means that it's going to contribute to the commercial prosperity of the business.
So the answer is that it's not a quick answer. Here's a trick to make it more comfortable. It is like anything. Practice.
Yeah.
Get a system.
Get a system.
Get somebody to teach you.
Practice it.
And then practice it.
And the other part, of course, is success breeds success.
Yeah.
So once a veterinarian starts to experience more yeses, their confidence improves. That will make subtle shifts in tonality of voice, facial expression, body language, passion even. One thing we say is that there is nothing that sells like passion. And I don't want to offend anybody by using the term sell. I mean that it's non-sales selling.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I say that, I influence clients to a yes with the best ethical recommendation. Nothing sells like passion. And the more confident we are, the more passionate we are about it. The more passionate, the more the client is going to buy into that proposition. And it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy or a positive cycle. The more yeses I get, the more passionate I become, and the more positive I am in my delivery, the more yeses I'm going to get. And it can fundamentally shift a veterinarian's day-to-day experience.
On the flip side, though, you talked last night about our negativity bias. And when you have the failure, the real bad one,
yeah,
which is not that common, but it sticks with you. So when you have the person who you do everything right, you think you do, and then they react in a really negative way. How much? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You guys have all the stuff that we hear.
Yes.
And then that stings. And I feel like sometimes that's why I struggle, because I've had a few of those. And then you're so wary of getting that reaction again that you're actually nervous going in there, because you're like, what if it's one of those again?
Where
I get my head chewed off for just trying to offer the value.
Yeah, and look, I think there's two parts to this. One is the recognition that that's a limbic response. That's the emotional response. It's fight, flight, or freeze type reaction.
The elephant gets upset.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly, when that client's, oh my God, that's ridiculous. What a ripoff.
Yeah.
Two things. Number one, that's kind of a specifically wired and primitive brain response. It's not that's kind of like, well, you know, risk here, threat, which of course is not really the threat that we feel in terms of physiological and emotional response.
Yeah.
We have that red alert system. We don't have an equivalent green alert system. So every time a client says, yes, that'd be great. Thank you. Thank you so much for what you did. Yeah, look, that's expensive, but I get it. We're going to perceive they don't have the same impact.
Yeah, it's there.
It's a different wiring system
altogether.
And then
you get the negative responses, which is a peak out of the normal, and your brain goes, watch out for those out of the normal situations.
Yeah, that's exactly why you can have 20, 30 successes in a day, and it's that one single one that question you that leaves the impression. And look, I think the first thing there is to try and approach this with curiosity. Okay. If a client was to react with something like,
all you care about is the money.
All you care about is the money. Oh my God, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Number one, and it's not easy, but try and stay out of judgment, because everyone's got a backstory. There is a reason why they're reacting the way they are. And there is a lot of gaps in their knowledge.
Yeah.
In order to react that way. So number one is to try and stay out of judgment here. And number two is to approach it with curiosity. And a really great, simple technique to do that is with what we call a mirror. And a mirror is a specific type of question where we replay the client's last 3, 4, 5 words just with an upward inflection. My God, that is a ripoff. I'm sorry. A ripoff. And what that does is it transfers directional control of the conversation back to the client. So rather than us going into a defensive posture, we hand back to them with curiosity to let them explain or own what they've just said. Because that's an emotional response on their part as well. And emotional responses are very often exaggerated and or embellished. So I'm just going to pass ownership back to you here. I'm going to let you control direction of the conversation, which avoids them being defensive. And it means we're not in a defensive posture either. We're in a curious posture. I'd like to understand what you just said and what makes you say that. I'm sorry. And then repeat what they've played back to them. It also demonstrates that we're listening at an unconscious or subconscious level when they hear their own words. They know they're being listened to.
So then how does that conversation go? Because let's say a guy goes, this is ridiculous. All you care about is the money. And I go, I'm sorry. All I care about is the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what? He going to go, yes. How do these play out?
Yeah.
I'm very curious.
So the way they play out is entirely dependent on what the next thing we hear is. And this is where a fundamental skill that we're not that great at becomes really important. That's listening. And we're not great at it because we're all wired to listen to respond rather than listen to understand. And so what happens is, particularly if we're feeling threatened or on a defensive, as the message is being delivered to us, we're busily thinking about, how am I going to respond to this? What am I going to say? And there's an element of emotion within this as well, because this is offensive or it's off-putting or it's upsetting. There is... it's going to take us off balance a little bit. So the next step really depends on what they say, and we've got to listen to understand. Okay. And we don't know where that's going to go. Presumably it's going to go down the path of a gap in understanding between what we actually do and the client's perception of what we do. And that's where we need to start educating and filling in those gaps.
So you can, because I've often heard that when somebody's in that heightened emotional state, they're trying to reason with them, they're not going to achieve it. So explaining to them, understand that it's a lot of money, we have wages of this, and you're trying to, doesn't normally work, because they don't want to hear that they're wrong.
Yeah.
They just want to be angry.
Yeah, look, and that's going to depend on the emotional intelligence of the client somewhat.
Low, I'd expect normally.
Yeah. Maybe you're acting this way, probably that's the case.
Yeah.
Not great self-regulation.
Yes.
And one of the things I found really helpful is to share or articulate, clearly there is a significant disconnect between your perception of what we do and what we actually do. A great step forward, or a great way forward, would be for you to come in and actually watch firsthand, not your pet, another pet, having a similar procedure. My experience was, and I'm not, this is not for everybody. I know that there are certainly veterinarians who are uncomfortable with clients watching their work, and I respect that. What I found was that most clients, once I said that, would say, oh, look, no, that won't be necessary. I guess I get it. Okay. Let's go ahead. Once I was willing to demonstrate that level of transparency, this is an open book, you're welcome to look. I also had a handful of clients who said, all right, I will take you up on that. I'd very much like to watch. What was interesting was, regardless of the magnitude of their emotional response in the first place, they became our biggest advocates.
Really?
It's seeing it firsthand was what transformed people's perceptions and bridged that gap, that gap of, and this with respect, ignorance.
Yeah. It is.
And I heard on numerous occasions, I had no idea. I will never complain about veterinary fees again.
We're almost alone, but that opens the whole rabbit hole of open hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And open clinics, which apparently solves a lot of those problems.
Yeah.
Because people are there watching the action.
Yeah, we talk about perception of value. We always welcomed clients behind the scenes. Unless there was something going on that was obviously inappropriate.
Yeah.
So there was a rare occasions where we didn't do that. But for the most part, it was an open book. The team were comfortable with it. They were used to it. In fact, one of our points of difference was that we had a beautiful purpose-built hospital. We'd like you to see it. Mm. The number of clients that said, God, this is better than where I go. So it's that fundamental make the invisible visible.
I once had a reaction to a client, but it's actually helped me in the long run de-escalate my own emotion. And specifically that sentence, all you care about is the money. I've often thought, I feel like that's the one we hate the most to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like the knife to the heart, because we feel like it's absolutely not true.
Oh, it could be further from the truth.
But hang on. It's not entirely untrue. It's not all I care about. But I do care about the money. The reality is, it is my job. I want to get paid for it. So why? I don't recommend doing this, but it came out because it was 3 in the morning and I was tired and grumpy and a woman was giving me a really hard time and she gave me that line. And I responded, I said, no, it's not all that I care about by a long shot, but at 3 in the morning, I definitely care about the money.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was quiet and she couldn't really respond. She was like, and I won't use that to the client, but I almost say it to myself when somebody has that sort of response. It's not entirely untrue. I get less angry at the clients when they say that because I'm like, yeah, it is. It's not all. I want the best outcome for your patient, but I still want to get paid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, there is that kind of fundamental rule of reciprocity.
Yeah.
There's a two-way exchange here.
Yeah.
And part of that is a financial one.
We've got to start wrapping up. There's a million things we could talk about, but we're almost at the hotel. And you were about to go to a talk.
I don't present so now 3 hours.
We've just warmed you up now. Your voice coach for future. I normally wrap up with a very quick one. Do you listen to podcasts?
I do.
Favorites at the moment?
My favorite podcasts, Tim Ferriss.
Yeah.
Sam Harris.
Yeah.
Peter Attia.
All of those.
They'd be my top three.
Yeah, love all of them.
Yep.
Good company. And then the last one, and this I usually give people warning for as well. But you have a couple of minutes to speak to all of the veterinary new grads of 2023 and just to give them one message, one bit of advice. or inspiration, what is Gary's message?
Wow, there's some responsibility that goes with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I could deliver a message to, and what I've seen in new graduates today, is you don't summit the mountain of clinical mastery overnight.
Forever.
It's a journey. It takes time. Be patient. You will get there. And recognize the learnings, because they're not failures. They're just learnings.
I like
that. Take your time. Yeah.
I'm going to disagree and say you're never going to reach the summit.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
But it gets much prettier the higher you get.
Yeah. Very
like,
much so.
Like up on the mountain today, the higher the lift goes, the better the snow. Kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that's a nice analogy.
Gary, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before you disappear, I wanted to tell you about our new weekly newsletter. I speak to so many interesting people and learn so many new things while making the podcast. So I thought I'd create a little summary each week of the stuff that stood out for me. We call it the VetVault 321, and it consists of, firstly, three clinical pearls. These are three things that I've taken away from the clinical podcast episodes. My light bulb moments, the penny dropping, any new facts, and the stuff that we need to know to make all the other pieces fit. Then, two other things. These could be quotes, links, movies, books, a podcast highlight, anything that I've come across outside of clinical vetting that I think you might find interesting. And then, one thing to think about. I'll share something that I'm pondering, usually based on something that I've read or heard, but sometimes it'll be just my own musings or rants. The goal of this format is that you can spend just 2 to 3 minutes on the clinical stuff and move right along if that's all that you're after. But if you're looking for content that is more nourishing than cat videos or doom scrolling, then our two other things should send you in the right direction. And then something extra for when you feel like a slightly longer read. If you'd like to get these in your inbox each week, then subscribe by following the newsletter link in the show description wherever you're listening to this. It's free, I think it's useful, it's fun, and it's easy to unsubscribe if it's not for you. Okay, we'll see you next time.